This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Welcome back to Path of a Green Witch podcast. In this episode, we are going to discuss the Turtle Island Liberation Front and the recent arrest of a few of their members. Today is December 15th, 2025, and this is Path of a Green Witch podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, let's unpack this. We were diving into a story that really dropped with these immediate sensational headlines,
right?
An alleged huge terror plot. But almost instantly, you know, that severity was met with this really loud skepticism.
The feeling that it might be a textbook case of state engineering or entrapment.
Exactly. So we're looking at sources around this group that federal authorities have named the Turtle Island Liberation Front, or TLF.
And the claims are big. We're talking coordinated bombings in a very ideologically charged narrative.
Yeah, they're linking it to far left, anti-capitalist, and pro-Palestine rhetoric.
Right.
But the sources we have, they're really demanding we treat this as highly suspect until proven otherwise.
That's the only reasonable position to take right now.
Yeah.
Our deep dive today is focused on that massive and frankly jarring gap between how severe the state's allegations are and just how tiny the alleged organization seems to be.
Right.
And we're going to use some historical precedent to give you the context you need to really, you know, critically assess this whole story as it unfolds.
And to be clear, we're not here to declare anyone guilty or innocent.
Not at all. We're here to understand the political and strategic mechanics that are at play whenever the government unveils a domestic terror plot like this one.
Absolutely. So let's start with the foundation. What is the official narrative? What are federal authorities actually claiming the TILF is? And, you know, what were they allegedly planning?
Okay, so U.S. authorities, they're defining TILF as a small, far-left extremist group.
And a violent, homegrown, anti-government group.
Right. What's really striking is just how quickly officials define their politics. I mean, they didn't just label them extremists. They really went for this maximalist political frame.
And those labels are so specific. You've got Attorney General Pam Bondi and others out there calling TILF far left, pro-Palestine, anti-government, and anti-capitalist.
Precisely. The sources detail how that frame connects the group's own alleged rhetoric, which they supposedly found in their materials, to calls for violence and revolution.
So they're taking the group's own words and spinning them into a threat narrative.
They are. The language they were allegedly using, it described their goals in terms of liberation through decolonization and tribal sovereignty. It's this mix of, you know, specific movement jargon and more generalized revolutionary talk.
So really high stakes political language. But what about the plot itself? Because that's what grabbed all the headlines.
The plot, I mean, as it's detailed in the DOJ complaint and the press briefings, it's just cinematic in scope. It really is.
It sounds like a movie script.
Totally. So authorities arrested four alleged members out in Lucerne Valley, that's east of L.A., and they're facing serious charges. Conspiracy, possession of an unregistered or destructive device, you know, the works.
And the targets, they weren't small. They were major infrastructural points, right?
Yes, exactly. The main plan they're alleging involves bombing at least five Amazon-type logistics centers all across the L.A. and Orange County area.
And timed specifically around New Year's Eve 2025.
Right. And then later, they allege the group was going to start targeting ICE agents and vehicles, immigration and customs enforcement.
Using pipe bombs. Yeah, that is just, it's a staggering list of allegations. Five coordinated bombings, then attacks on federal law enforcement.
And authorities are claiming, you know, we have the evidence. They say they seized explosive materials. They have recordings of planning conversations.
Well, they were testing them in the desert.
They further claim the group was testing or getting ready to test explosives out in the desert near where they were arrested. So the whole narrative law enforcement is building is one of a major imminent threat that they just narrowly averted.
Okay, let's pivot here, because this is where the real work of this deep dive begins. I mean, the scale of that alleged plot, it demands a serious investigation. But our sources point to this massive, crucial disconnect.
This is the core issue. This is what we're calling the critical asymmetry.
Between the charges and the size of the group.
Exactly. Despite being framed as this major threat, the group's actual public footprint was, well, it was minuscule.
How small are we talking?
Look at the data from national outlets. The group's main Instagram account had, get this, under 60 followers around the time of the arrests.
Under 60?
60.
60. And the whole LA chapter had fewer than 1,000.
A high school baking club has a bigger digital presence. I mean, how do you square that tiny social media footprint with the government suddenly labeling them a major ideological front that can pull off a coordinated attack on 5 logistics centers?
You can't. Organically, it doesn't compute. And the sources suggest that this disproportionate scale is a huge red flag. It points not to a real potent threat, but to the political utility of the narrative itself.
So the question isn't, could they have done it?
The real question is why the state would amplify a story about such a tiny group in the first place.
What does the state really gain, though, by amplifying it? I mean, with targets like logistics centers and ICE, you're going to get a massive public response anyway, aren't you? Regardless of how big the group is. Oh, you'll get a response, but it's a strategically tailored one. By attaching those big political labels, anti-capitalist, pro-Palestine, decolonization to alleged violence, the state builds this really convenient narrative. These labels map, as the sources say, neatly onto current fear narratives.
Ah, so the narrative itself becomes the weapon.
Exactly. It lets the state use the actions of this tiny, maybe violent cell to create what the sources call a chilling effect.
Discouraging wider nonviolent movements.
Right. Legitimate indigenous rights groups, Palestine solidarity organizers, they get smeared by association. I mean, think about it. If a DOJ complaint uses the language of decolonization to arrest alleged terrorists, it automatically justifies more surveillance and scrutiny of nonviolent activists who just happen to use the same vocabulary.
So the takeaway is clear. The story we have right now is partial and it's strategic. It's built entirely from law enforcement press releases and the DOJ complaint.
Which means we have to see it for what it is. A tool being deployed, not necessarily a verified truth. The current story isn't based on independently tested evidence.
And that critical stance, it completely validates that gut feeling that so many people have, that this sounds like a CIA story, you know?
Yeah.
A classic setup.
Your gut is right on this one.
When you have a super small group, really high stakes rhetoric, and this highly cinematic plot. I mean, history tells us to be suspicious.
That suspicion is completely warranted. It aligns perfectly with the fact pattern we see in historical counterterrorism stings. The most grounded position you can take here is to treat the whole operation and narrative as highly suspect and politically useful to the state.
Okay, so if we're working from that assumption that this might be an engineered plot, what are the clearest red flags that the sources point to? What should we be looking for?
All right. Number one is that fundamental asymmetry we keep coming back to. The grand front language in the indictment versus the, you know, tiny group with almost no organic public base.
Because entrapment cases often target marginal groups.
They're the easiest to manipulate. They often don't have the resources to fund a real plot or a real legal defense.
Okay. What's the second red flag?
The second is the very specific, highly prosecutable evidence they claim to have. Things like recordings of plotting, tested explosives in the desert, a concrete New Year's Eve mass casualty plan.
Right.
These are common props in sting operations where an informant or an undercover agent's job is to push the target past just angry talk and into concrete, legally actionable prep.
And that point, it just immediately brings to mind the critical precedent for this whole thing, the 2020 Michigan governor kidnapping plot.
You have to view it through that lens.
Yeah.
You just have to. The Michigan case has structural similarities that just, they perfectly mirror the TILF allegations.
You had a small marginal group.
Yep. Militia types in that case.
Yes.
With these spectacular cinematic alleged plans.
Yeah.
Kidnap a sitting governor. You know, tactical action against state officials.
And it all mapped neatly onto the political fear narratives of the time.
Perfectly. Anti-government extremism.
So for anyone who needs a quick refresher on the Michigan case, the defense lawyers basically argued that the government fabricated the whole conspiracy. And for some of the defendants, that argument worked. Why?
Because the sheer depth of government involvement was just astounding. The defense successfully argued that the government engineered the conspiracy. They showed that at least a dozen FBI informants and undercover agents were involved.
A dozen.
At least. And it wasn't passive observation. The agents and informants were active participants. They were suggesting tactical ideas, providing training, supplying material, pushing the timeline.
So the informants were the catalysts.
Absolutely. They were often the ones steering vague, angry talk into something prosecutable. That massive government role is why the courts and juries acquitted several defendants and let others plead down their charges.
And when you realize that the government essentially manufactured the concrete parts of a terror plot in Michigan, it just demands we look at every similar case, including this one, through that same lens.
You have to.
The implications for civil liberties are enormous. It's not about guilt anymore. It's about figuring out who wrote the script.
That's it. Exactly.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
The sources suggest that treating this Turtle Island case as Michigan style until proven otherwise is the only intellectually defensible stance right now. It means you just assume a heavy informant or undercover role led to them getting explosives and making those key recordings until independent evidence proves otherwise.
Okay, so let's step back from the speculation for a minute and just define the ground truth. What are the concrete facts in the public record we can actually stand on?
The facts are pretty limited. One, four people were arrested in Lucerne Valley.
Okay.
Two, specific federal charges, including conspiracy, have been filed. And three, authorities claim they seized explosive materials and recordings. That's it. That's the verifiable public foundation.
And we have to be nuanced here, right? The sources stress that just because the story is one-sided doesn't mean it's 100% fabricated.
Right. There is no publicly available evidence confirming a setup. Not yet.
That's the challenge.
It is. We can't honestly sit here and say we have definitive proof they were set up. Because the underlying evidence, the chat logs, the informant reports, the timeline of who suggested what, none of that is public or has been tested in court.
So if you were the defense and you were trying to prove entrapment, what's the evidence you'd need? What's the smoking gun?
You need to show that the people charged were predisposed to talk big, but not to actually act. Specifically, you'd need proof that an informant or an agent was the one who suggested the targets or supplied the bomb-making materials or, you know, kept pushing for violence when they were hesitant.
So the state provided the means or the motivation?
Or both. You'd also want to show that the defendants just didn't. They lacked the technical capacity or the money to do any of this until state actors stepped in to provide it.
Right.
And third, you try to prove that these so-called plots were just aspirational, angry talk, you know, venting on some encrypted chat before law enforcement came in and structured it all into a concrete, prosecutable narrative.
So that framework gives you, the listener, a fantastic plan for watching this story as it develops. This is your critical thinking action plan.
Mm-hmm.
First, you watch to see if those alleged recordings or chat transcripts ever become public record, or do prosecutors just keep summarizing the evidence in court filings without ever showing the raw data? That's a huge clue.
A massive clue. Second, watch for the informant details to emerge. We need to know if there was that sting-style escalation where agents were the ones introducing the ideas or the means or the money. That stuff usually comes out during discovery, long after the big headlines have faded.
And finally, watch how the associated political movements respond. If legitimate indigenous and Palestine-aligned groups immediately and forcefully say, "We have no connection to this," it really highlights the state's strategic goal, doesn't it?
It does. It shows they're using this group's alleged violence to strategically smear wider political movements that just happen to share some of their language, but not their consent.
So ultimately, the risk here is what it always is in these cases.
It's that the state uses a guided or heavily inflated plot to accomplish political goals. They get new counterterror budgets, new surveillance powers, and most importantly, they create enough public fear to chill participation in legitimate, nonviolent political organizing just by association.
The spectacle is the point.
The spectacle is very often the primary objective.
So what does this all mean? The most important question this deep dive raises isn't just what the charges are, but who benefits most from the spectacular cinematic parts of this story. The five Amazon centers, the New Year's Eve deadline.
Who does that serve?
Exactly. What happens when an extremely small group is given a maximally large platform by the government? So here's something to mull over on your own. Try to track down the actual federal complaint if you can access it and read it. But don't read it as an objective document. Read it like a COINTEL profile.
Look for the pattern.
Yes. Who initiates the key actions? Who escalates the planning from just talk to actual action? And who provides the means? Those details are going to tell you far more about how this operation really worked than any headline ever will.
The United States government has a long, well-documented record of repressing its own population when they step outside approved channels of dissent. From COINTELPRO's surveillance, sabotage, and assassination of Black, Indigenous, left, and anti-war organizers, to the brutal policing of labor strikes, civil rights marches, and anti-globalization protests. The pattern is clear. When people seriously challenge concentrated power, they are met with infiltration, criminalization, and violence. In every generation, those who dare to expose imperial wars, corporate corruption, racist policing, or colonial land theft are smeared as extremists or terrorists. They are prosecuted under vague national security laws and held up as warnings to anyone else who might rebel. This is proof that in the United States, rights exist on paper, but the price of real dissent is often paid in ruined lives and stolen futures. We must resist. Medicom's fire still burns. This is Path of a Green Witch podcast. Thank you for listening.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.